Goeienaand weer en baie welkom by ons program wat handel oor sterre en planete. Ons gaste vanavond is Jim Adams, soos gewoonlik is hy die eerste sondag van die maand aan diens, en ons gaan oor 'n interessante projek gesels. Ons het ook by ons vir professor Mati Hofman en vir Willie Koorts. Ons gaan net nou luister na Kobus Olkers met ruimte weernuus, maar eers ruimte nuus, wat geskryf word deur Herman Turin in Bloemfontein. In die stadium lyk het betrekkelijk seker dat die eerste mens op 'n planeet van ons sonnestelsel sy bestemming Mars sal wees. Die maan is 51 jaar gelede reeds deur besoekers van die aarde af betree, maar nou vorder die Artemis-projek flink vir die reuse stap verder. Weens die veel langer reis na Mars as destyds na die maan, sal het een veel groter operasie na die rooi planeet wees. Wat blyk seker te wees, is dat die ruimtemanne se stapelvoedsel tydens die reise, die verblyf en die terugreis aardappels sal wees. Anders as ander stapelvoedsels, kan geoeste aardappels nie lang in die atmosfeer hou nie, wat beteken dat vars aardappels gereeld geoes sal moet word. Een experiment om vars drinkwater in die ruimte uit die waterstof te onttrek, het pas geslaag. Toetse om aardappelsoorte te vind wat op Mars en in Marsgrond sal aard, is 'n paar jaar gelede buite Lima, die hoofstad van Peru, gedoen. Altesaam 65 aardappelsoorte is aanvanklik in die toetse ingespan om veelbelovende Mars aardappels te vind. Twee types aardappels is gevind en nog twee cultivars is geteel deur ander soorte met mekaar te kruis. Indianen van die Andes het reeds lang gelede verskeie variëteite planttypes gekruis en verskeie soorte aardappels daaruit geteel. Vooral twee types het goed geaard en die grondslag van 'n groot getal variëteite gevorm, waarvan twee soorte vandag die grondslag van bruikbare moderne aardappels uitmaak. Intussen het Nederlandse wetenskaplikes aangekondig dat hulle daarin geslaag het om 10 ander types groente te ontwikkel wat op Mars kan groei. Hieronder tel tomaties, erkies, gars en radijse. Al die gewasse sal in ondergrondse vertrekke gekweek word om hulle teen onder meer ruimtebestraling te beskerm. Hollywood druk sy stempel al harder op gedenkdae uit die ruimte af. Nou vanjaar is daar die volgende twee aan die beurt. 4 Mei is dan Star Wars dag en die 5de April First Contact dag. Daarmee die einde van die nuus wat geskryf is deur Herman Turin in Bloemfontein. Nou stel ons vir Kobus Olkers in Florida, Amerika aan die woord.
Goeienaand hierdie en goeienaand luisteraars. Ja, ons het vir ons 'n interessante son verlede week gehad en hierdie week. Die onstabiele area, die magnetiese komplekse area wat ons verlede week oor gepraat het, het so 'n bietjie gegroei. En hy het die hele klomp klein vakkeltjies afgeskiet, maar niks wat ons regtig beïnvloed het, wat ons apparaat en so aan te doen het nie. Ons het wel 'n paar prachtige mooie auroras gekry in die verre noorde en suide as gevolg daarvan. En dit is natuurlijk dan ook die gevolg van 'n baie groot koronagat, wat so net boek aan die noordpool van die son sit, dan word hy is baie goed na ons kant toe gekorrel. En hy is nou geo-effektief hierdie week. So ons gaan definitief van hom af 'n bietjie ekstra sonwindspoed kry, wat natuurlik gaan beteken dat ons langafstand radiogebruikers se frekwensies gaan beïnvloed word. Dan verder is daar net twee klein kroonkoronagaatjies by die noord en die suidpole, en ek noem hulle omdat hulle nou begin kleiner word. Ons sou kan onthou vir die afgelope 4-5 jaar het ons redelik baie van grootes gepraat. Hulle raak nou al hoe kleiner soos wat die sonsiklus nou begin toeneem. Die effek van die sonsiklus. En dan is daar nog 'n klein koronagaatjie wat laat in die week gaan effektief raak. Hier so teen Vrydag se koers. Dit lyk asof hy baie sterk noord gerig is. En dit gaan dalk die effek van die ander een 'n bietjie uitkanselleer, wat vir ons langafstand radioluisteraars werk. En dan die laaste ding is 'n redelike menigte van filamente hier in die suidelike halfrond van die son. Dit is baie onstabiel in daai omgewing, maar dit lyk nie of enigeen van hulle gaan platval of opstyg nie. So dit is ons storie vir die son. Ek glo nie ons internet of selfone gaan beïnvloed raak nie, maar Ons langafstand luisteraars sal het wel sien en die mense in die verre noorde en syde gaan mooi aurora sien. Goeienaand allemaal.
Dit was dan Kobus Olkers in Florida, Amerika. Nou soos ek laas week gesê het, het ons vir Jim Adams nou weer by ons, soos gewoonlik, die eerste Sondag in die maand. En ons gaan vanavond fokus op 'n interessante projek wat in die toekoms van plaasvind en waarby Jim betrokke was. Die sogenaamde Dragonfly project. Dit is dan eintlik maar die naaldekoker project. But Jim, before we carry on, I would just like to react on a question that I got from one of our listeners who mentioned your pronunciation of Mikey Swontyke. And he said he'd like to hear it again. Could you try again?
Well, I've been practicing. the place where the NASA Deep Space Network antenna is going to be built in South Africa is Mikiesfontein.
Wow. Perfect.
And because I practiced, it probably isn't quite as funny as when I said it last week. But
okay. Now, let's talk about the Dragonfly project. It's due to fly to Titan. When is it due to be launched?
It recently sustained a launch delay because of COVID-19, of all things. The mission was selected in June of 2019, and they now have a launch date set for 2036. And it will take 9 years to get to the Saturn system and Titan.
Why Titan?
Well, you know, Titan is a mysterious place. If it weren't in orbit around Saturn, it would be considered a planet. It's larger than Mercury. It's actually the second largest moon in the solar system, and it's the only moon in the solar system that we know of that has a thick, dynamic atmosphere. So it's a very mysterious place. It's got chemical processes that are ongoing even now. In the southern hemisphere, it's actually raining, and the what we thought were dry lake beds are starting to fill up. So there's this hydrological cycle on Titan, much like we have on Earth, you know, where you have evaporation and condensation and precipitation and accumulation. But on Titan, it's not water. It's actually liquid methane. And the raindrops, they say, are about the size of your fist. So it's an amazing place. And we believe it might help us understand how life formed on Earth, because this is such a prehistoric kind of destination in our solar system. We picture it as being one of the phases that Earth might have gone through in its evolution.
Jim, just a quick question. I think it was in January 24 when the Huygens probe landed on Titan, and it was great excitement when the first actual surface photos of Titan were sent back to Earth. But that probe survived only a few hours because of the extreme cold. I mean, you mentioned there's liquid methane and nitrogen, and it's just incredible the cold that any technology will have to survive. And it's already a problem on Mars with the Ingenuity, which have to use quite some energy to cool its electronics. Now, how on earth are this mission going to work to have
probe? So this is just such another visionary mission. And I should point out that this is being built by the same people that built the New Horizons probe that flew to Pluto, right? That's at the Applied Physics Lab in Laurel, Maryland, here in the United States. And, of course, the Curiosity and the Perseverance and Ingenuity, they were all built at the Jet Propulsion Lab in California. When the Huygens probe landed, Cassini dropped it off, and it entered the Titan atmosphere and descended down through it on a parachute. And it took a long time because the atmosphere on Titan is four times as dense as it is here on Earth. But the gravity is only 1/7. So it kind of floated down to the surface. And it only had a battery, so it lasted as long as the battery could keep it alive. In the case of Dragonfly, and we'll get to the connection that it has to Mars in a minute technologically, it's going to carry the same nuclear power supply that the Curiosity and Perseverance rovers have. So the multi-mission radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or MMRTG, will be supplying it about 100 or 90 watts, depending upon the life cycle, throughout the mission lifetime. It'll get dropped off with a parachute, and once its descent is slowed enough, then amazingly, it's going to turn on rotors and become a quadcopter. And this thing that weighs about half as much as the Perseverance rover. So remember, Ingenuity on Mars weighed about 2 kilograms. This thing weighs nearly 450 kilograms. And so on its descent, parachute will, heat shield and parachute, they'll deploy off once it gets slowed down. It'll fire up these quadcopter rotors and descend itself down to the surface.
So the advantage here is, of course, the thick atmosphere and the feeble gravity. Yeah. So coming back to the power source, yeah, and of course that generates heat as a byproduct, which is great, because you can now, it looks like about 70 watts will be available for the electronics, and then some heat to keep it alive.
That's true, and of course the MMRTG makes makes a bunch of heat that never gets converted to electricity, and so the folks at the Department of Energy here in the United States have come up with a way of running heat pipes over the fins or in the vicinity of the MMRTG to capture that reject heat and then reuse it elsewhere to keep the both Perseverance, Curiosity, and most likely Dragonfly alive.
The energy source for the rotor motors, what will that be?
Yeah, it'll. So the multi-mission radioisotope thermoelectric generator generates about 90 watts or 100 watts, depending. And that charges up a battery. And then the battery is discharged as the rotors fly. And of course, the MMRTG, we talked about this before, uses plutonium-238 as its source. So as the plutonium-238 decays, it makes heat. The heat gets turned into electricity. And then, of course, it goes from there to the battery and then from the battery to the rotor motors. The other amazing thing about the Dragonfly mission is it's not going to be flying in terms of seconds. Each sortie can be up to 6 kilometers long. And in its 2.7 year mission lifetime, it will travel further than all of the Mars rovers combined by double. So it'll travel twice as far and further than all of the Mars rovers have combined.
This craft, is it supposed to just fly, or does it have wheels?
No, it's got skids, so it only flies. So when it first arrives at Titan, it'll descend down through the atmosphere. Get settled in on a region on the equator called Shangri-La. And Shangri-La is an amazing place because it's got a lot of diversity for sampling. But NASA likens the Shangri-La linear dunes to this to similar linear dunes in Namibia.
Sounds like Yapi all over here. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. would have loved that.
Just another question. It's a bit difficult to have a feeling for the energy use for the flying of this dragonfly. Okay, the fact that gravity is 7 times weaker than on Earth means it will take much less energy just to keep it up. I mean, even if it's not flying forward. But now the density of the atmosphere will cause much more atmospheric resistance. Do you have any estimate on what fraction of the energy will be used just to keep it up, not falling down, versus actual traveling forward?
Yeah, no, I don't. But what I can tell you is about the rotors. So just like Ingenuity had, remember, Ingenuity had these two blades that were counter-rotating? And remember, the Ingenuity blades were 1.2 meters in diameter. So Dragonfly will have four groups of two blades also counter-rotating just like Ingenuity, but their blades are smaller. And the blades are smaller because of, as you mentioned, the gravity is less. It's 1/7 of what we have here on Earth, and it's and the atmosphere is much more dense than it is on Mars. You know, 4 times the Earth's density compared to at Mars, it's only 1% of the Earth's density. So, so the blades, the hovering will be much more efficient for the because of the atmosphere. I really don't know. Maybe they haven't even figured out yet how much of that energy is going to be needed for translating versus hovering. So,
and I'm sure they're going to learn a lot now from Ingenuity, which will just help with this rotor design, with the blade design, I suppose.
You can bet, and operations as well. The operations team, I bet, have already started to collaborate to try and determine what are the lessons learned from operating Ingenuity, so that they can apply those to the planning for the real thing at Titan.
Yeah, and the time delay of the signals will be much bigger than in the case of Mars, because Saturn is so much further.
Yes. Yeah. At the moment, the time delay one way between Titan and Earth is about 88 minutes, I believe.
Oh. Yeah, and I see that a day on Titan is something like 190 odd hours. So yeah. long days. And it sounds like during the Titan night, that's when the batteries will recharge. As you say, this reactor gives electricity all the time, but you will be using more electricity during day for experimentation and for flying every so often.
Yeah, and it's going to carry a beautiful suite of instruments, spectrometers, and things to look for biological activity, you know, signs that maybe there was prebiotic life forming. It's going to be a fantastic mission.
Even a drill to drill down and collect samples under the surface.
I would think that they must.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah, that.
Uh-huh. Yes, I think one of the big differences here is that this craft will be an all-in-one device, whereas, you know, we had separate things, Perseverance and Ingenuity on Mars, the most recent mission. Dragonfly is all on its own. It's got everything.
Yeah. And, you know, to be fair, it's much harder to get to the surface of Mars because there's really no atmosphere to work with. I mean, of consequence. So like they say, there's no atmosphere really to help you, but enough of an atmosphere that you have to deal with it.
But anyway, it was just saying about on its own, I've also seen that the Huygensstaay probe still had the what was it called? It was going around the moon, but in this case, it'll have to even do its own communication with the deep space network. There's no craft relaying any of the messages.
That's correct. So Cassini relayed the messages from the Huygens probe back in 2006. And then obviously Dragonfly is going by itself, as Henny mentioned. And so the radio transmissions will be direct to Earth. And because of that, the Dragonfly carries a much bigger antenna than the Huygens probe did.
It sounds quite a bit like science fiction, what is all integrated into the system. Will they dare to scoop up some liquid from one of the liquid methane oceans or whatever it's exactly consisting out of?
Well, you know, at first they're going to be really cautious, aren't they? I'll bet as they get more and more comfortable with the way the craft flies and how the instruments operate, and as they get closer and closer maybe to the end of the mission, they'll start to do some things that might be a tad riskier. And that would include getting closer and closer to the I call it water line, methane line, right?
Imagine being hit by a raindrop that's the size of your fist. That'll take it out of the sky. That's for sure.
Yeah, Saturn has a host of moons. Where in the line? We know Titan is the biggest, the largest one, but where in the line is Titan? Is it quite close to Saturn, or is it a bit further away?
So maybe our astronomers can answer that question. What I do know is that Titan was close enough to Saturn that Cassini used it a lot. And I forget how many flybys we did, but we used it a lot for gravitational assist in order to change the course direction of Cassini. But I don't know what sequence it's in.
It must be quite close to Enceladus.
Well, they're all moving, aren't they?
Yeah, but I mean, because Cassini did also work on Enceladus, isn't it, or what?
To be honest, I know Enceladus has these amazing plumes, but Cassini just got to fly through them. And the reason that it was able to fly through Enceladus's plumes was because we were able to target that destination by doing a particular kind of fly around Titan.
I'm just quickly looking here at a photo collage of all the major moons of the solar system, and Titan at Saturn, and compares well almost equally with Ganymede at Jupiter, and close to them is Callisto. And other than those three ones, all the other moons are quite a lot smaller than these three giant moons.
Yeah, and of course our own. Yeah,
just something else. We now know that Ingenuity has done a few extra flights, so it's been quite successful.
Yeah, I'm sure the team is just pleased as punch, and I like the notion. I forgot who proposed it, but one of you guys did that. You could turn Ingenuity into a feather duster if we get too much debris on top of the Perseverance rover.
That'll be risky to have two projects so close to each other, I suppose.
Yeah, which is exactly why Perseverance backed away to the Von Ziel overlook.
We had a question from a listener who asks why during a spaceflight you have these huge shudderings when you come back or go out. Why does the spacecraft shudder so much? What is the reason?
Largely due to variations in the density in atmospheres. So if you're thinking about like a human craft, like the SpaceX Crew Dragon, it goes through various layers of the atmosphere, and there's turbulence and that sort of thing. And when you're moving that fast, the tiniest perturbation in the atmosphere and the change in drag, maybe on one side of the capsule compared to the other, will cause the spacecraft to shake and shudder. Must be very exciting, maybe even a little scary for the astronauts.
like the Dragon flight that has just taken place, with the astronauts going to the ISS, do they have special seats for this type of thing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, each astronaut gets a custom-made seat. So it fits their body specifically, so that the shuddering and the shaking and the impact of the launch and descent are at least attempted to be minimized.
Well, even with the Soyuz crafts, you have people living up on the ISS for quite a number of months. Do they have these specially made chairs with them, or where are they stowed?
So what happens is when the Soyuz goes up, it stays docked with the space station. Hmm. And then when a crew returns, they take the Soyuz back with them. The same with the crew, with the SpaceX Crew Dragon.
So I'm just suddenly wondering. So
that way it functions as a sort of a lifeboat, doesn't it? You know, in case you need to get out quickly.
Yeah. So after 6 months in space, you're going to change shape slightly. So then your seat doesn't fit you anymore.
Probably won't so fit exactly fall. Right. Will it?
Right. I think we have to call it I wanted to say a day, but it's evening. Jim, you can be reached on our Facebook group, Sterra Planeta.
Yeah, absolutely. I love answering questions on the Facebook group. I'll try one more Afrikaans on you. I'll just say, Oyanant.
Ja, perfect. Wille, jou besonderhede.
Mense kan bel SMS WhatsApp 072-45-79-208.
En dan Mati?
083-625-7154. 083-625-7154.
En dan die programse e-postadres Sterreplanete by gmail.com. Sterreplanete by gmail.com. Tot volgende week. Mooi loop.